Now, it's my pleasure to welcome to the session on IG subclass and specific antibody deficiency. This morning's session will be presented by Dr. Kenneth Paris and Dr. Ricardo Sorensen. Dr. Paris is an associate professor of pediatrics in the Division of Allergy Immunology at Louisiana State University Health Services School of Medicine. It's a big name. He is also the division head of Allergy Immunology Department and the director of the Allergy Immunology Fellowship Program. Dr. Paris is an attending physician of the Children's Hospital of New Orleans. Dr. Sorensen is a special doc to me. He was my doc who treated me with IVIG starting in 1981. It was the initial studies for immune globulin in the U.S. I have to say that I'm here to some degree because of Dr. Sorensen. He left Cleveland and moved to New Orleans, where he is now the director of pediatrics at Louisiana State University Health Services School of Medicine. He's also the director of the Allergy Immunology Department at Children's Hospital of New Orleans and an attending physician on the faculty. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Paris and Dr. Sorensen.
Thank you. So it's always nice to get a nice introduction like that and a welcome, but actually Ricardo and I really wanted to welcome you guys to our city for the weekend and hope you have a wonderful time and get a lot of good learning in over the next 2 days, really. I'm not going to disclose where I was or what grade I was in 1981. But I think I've come a long way, and I'm really privileged to be able to work with Dr. Sorensen because he has a lot of experience in this particular topic. So I was tasked with the job or the role of talking about IgG subclass deficiency, and Dr. Sorensen will be talking about specific antibody deficiency. And there is some overlap. I think what we'd like to do together is to do some didactic or some presentation to you where we can teach you what we know and then open up the floor and give everyone in the audience an opportunity to ask us questions, which is really why this session has been spread over about 2 hours. I don't think that we could really, and you would tolerate us speaking for 2 hours straight, but I think that if it becomes a little more interactive, we all can learn from one another about these two diseases. So I will talk right now about IgG subclass deficiency. So let's see. I do have some disclosures. They asked us to do this. So I've spoken on behalf of Baxalta, CSL Behring, and I author a chapter with Dr. Sorensen about these topics right here on the online journal, which many physicians read, called UpToDate. And Dr. Sorensen also has some research funding that is provided by Baxalta and is my co-author on UpToDate. So if you were at the session yesterday in the late afternoon, you might have seen this slide. And I'm repeating it because I know not everyone could be here. So this slide is really just to introduce the concept of our immune system and our immunity and why most of the world really does not have a problem with infections. Every one of us in the world occasionally gets ill, but we have what's called an immune system that is very complex, which fights off those infections. And that immune system is composed of different types of cells, right? I mentioned many of them yesterday. Some of those produce proteins called antibodies, and then we also have organs within our body where those immune cells develop, where they function, and make these proteins that help us prevent infections. This is a little boy. Everybody's grandmother would think that this little kid is going to get horribly ill from being exposed to so many germs, right? Don't go out and play. When you come in, wash all that dirt off. Well, the reality is we're exposed to germs all the time, and for the majority of people in the world, we don't get sick, right? Our immune system fights off that infection, and we go on about our daily lives. So in the last slide, I mentioned that the immune system was comprised of various types of cells. And for the talk today, we're going to concentrate on the part of our immune system that deals with a particular cell called a B cell. B cells, you really could think of it as a war factory. It is the cell within our body that acts sort of like those defense contractors. They make all of the stuff that's used in war, okay? And in this case, what these B cells make are proteins called antibodies. Antibodies basically defend our body from foreign invaders or things that we like to consider to be danger signals. And that's usually bacteria or viruses or in some cases fungi. So another thing that we could think about when we talk about antibodies is that these are really, quote, danger busters. They attack or somehow interact with that danger signal. They're designed to seek out to specifically recognize that enemy invader, that bacteria, and that virus. And they can do multiple different things, all right? They can help prevent viral infections from even in sort of coming to clinical attention. So they can sort of attack the virus before it even infects our body, thereby preventing infection. And that's sort of the concept of why we immunize children. It's in some cases meant to create an attenuated or a less virulent disease, but in many cases it's designed to produce antibodies that will actually prevent the infection entirely. Some antibodies can help to neutralize toxins. Many foreign invaders, bacteria or viruses, produce toxins. And there are antibodies within our bloodstream and within gamma globulin that may neutralize those toxins. And then antibodies also have a very important role in actually sticking to bacteria. In some cases, antibodies don't necessarily destroy the foreign invader, but they coat that bacteria with a layer of protein or layer of antibodies that allows a different part of our immune system to interact and kill that bacteria. So they have lots of different functions. On the right-hand side of the screen, what you'll see is a little picture with those little cartoon of antibodies. And you'll see that those three letters or those three words, and that's IgG, IgA, and IgM. So IgG, IgA, and IgM are the antibodies in our bloodstream that are produced by B cells that help us fight infection, okay? IgG, IgA, IgM, those are words that you're going to hear over and over again probably during the weekend, and you've probably heard them over and over in your physician's office, okay? So antibodies bind to the foreign danger signal, and what is unique about the way we make antibodies in our immune system, so in our body, is that they get better with age. We have methods within the immune system, and this is very complex and I'm not going to get into it, where the production of antibodies can actually improve over time. With each exposure to a foreign danger signal and with some help of the other immune cells, the way we make antibodies gets stronger and the way those antibodies recognize and act upon the danger signal can get better. Okay, I mentioned that they help by coating bacteria and that they respond very quickly after a second exposure. So the first time we get a cold, for example, or an infection by a bacteria, it takes a while for our immune system to kick in. But if you are re-exposed to that, in general, the immune response is better. It works faster, and the antibodies that are produced, like I just mentioned, work a little bit better. I already mentioned that antibodies can be induced by vaccination in normal individuals, and that it evolves the most over time. So we're here today to talk specifically about IgG, all right? I'm going to mention a little bit about IgA in a future slide, but let's concentrate on IgG right now. So IgG, or immunoglobulin G, is the antibody that is probably most important in our body to work to prevent and help us clear infections. The major reason why it's most important is because it makes up the most of the total immunoglobulin level, okay? It provides long-lasting protection to infections. Once our immune system is induced to make IgG antibodies, that production typically lasts for months, years, and even decades in some cases, okay? So when we produce an IgG response, we can fairly reliably expect that that ability to fight off infections will last quite a long time. It's true. Sometimes we need some reminders or some boosters to help our immune system function normally. And a good example of that is the need to get a tetanus booster every 10 years, right? So we get immunized. We are now protected against tetanus. But every so often, about, 8 to 10 years, they recommend that people get a booster for tetanus in order to sort of kickstart that immune response and make a higher level of antibody to protect yourself, okay? So IgG subclasses are on the left. The total IgG is made up of four different, what we call subclasses, or different forms of IgG. IgG1 is the subclass which is present in the highest concentration within our bloodstream. About 65% of the total IgG is made up of IgG1. IgG2 comprises about 25% of the total IgG. IgG3, about 8%. And IgG4 is a very, very small component of that total subclass, of that total IgG level. And you notice that they add up to 100% at the bottom. So what exactly is IgG subclass deficiency? So there's a very sort of classic definition, and we call an IgG subclass deficiency to occur when someone has a persistent low level of one or more IgG subclass, but who has a normal total IgG level, okay? And so let's think about what that means in regards to these IgG subclasses. So IgG1, which is right here, makes up 65% of the total, okay? Which means that if IgG1 is low on its own, if that's the only subclass that would be deficient, that would probably result in a total IgG deficiency. So you would have what's called, by definition, a hypogammaglobulinemia, okay? So patients who have an IgG1 deficiency, we usually don't consider them to only have an IgG subclass deficiency. We would classify them in a different PI called hypogammaglobulinemia, all right? And that would lead us down a different path in regards to evaluation and, in some cases, management of the immune deficiency. So isolated IgG1 subclass deficiencies are fairly rare because they typically result in a different PI altogether. Okay? You might be classified in CVID or hypogammaglobulinemia if that's the case. Moving down to the bottom, IgG4. I mentioned that that is present in very, very small numbers, right? It only makes up 2% of the total IgG concentration. And because it makes up such a small component of the IgG total level, when it's a little bit low, it really doesn't impact our immune response very much. So most people think that deficiencies in IgG4 do not have a lot of clinical relevance. IgG4 can actually be absent in normal individuals in the general population. So unless there's a really strong clinical history and we're able to identify some problems fighting off infections that we could contribute to IgG4, we typically don't feel that IgG4 subclass deficiency is a clinically relevant deficiency. And of course, there's some exceptions to that rule, but in general, IgG1 and IgG4 deficiencies are not things that we typically deal with in our practice. And that leaves IgG2 and IgG3. So these are the most common forms of IgG subclass deficiency, and we'll talk a little bit about that, both myself and Dr. Sorensen, in the rest of the presentation. So, the clinical signs of IgG subclass deficiency. I think you probably all know that because you're here, because either you or a loved one suffers from subclass deficiency or specific antibody deficiency. And so because we receive immunoglobulin from our mother through the placenta, and it takes 6 months for that to sort of wash out of a baby's bloodstream, the onset of symptoms almost always occurs around the age of 6 months in an infant, okay? So if an IgG subclass deficiency is present in the first year or two of life, it most typically doesn't cause problems until the baby is about 4 or 6 months of age, okay? Like all the rest of the antibody deficiencies, subclass deficiencies present with recurrent upper and lower respiratory tract illnesses. They typically present with otitis media or ear infections, lower respiratory infections like pneumonia or bronchitis, or recurrent lower respiratory tract infections, LRTIs we call them. And occasionally in slightly older children, we start to see sinusitis. Babies don't have sinusitis because their sinus cavities are not well developed and they can't really get locked in infections in those poorly aerated sinuses. But as children get older and they become 2 and 3, 4, 5, 6 years of age, we start to see sinusitis as a problem in patients with subclass deficiencies. It's unusual for patients with subclass deficiency to get severe or recurrent invasive infections, although, of course, immunologists who have been practicing for a while do have cases in their practice where they can document fairly severe infections in patients with subclass deficiencies, and we'll talk about one of those types of situations, I think, in a few slides. At the bottom in small letters, I wrote a few things down because I think they're important to recognize, and that would be bronchiectasis. That's a name or a term that probably we don't use very much in IgG subclass deficiencies because it's very rarely a problem. Bronchiectasis is a long-standing infection within the lung tissue that results in scarring and severe pulmonary disease. I don't feel that that is a big problem in patients with subclass deficiencies who are properly treated. And if it did occur in a patient whose only diagnosis was subclass deficiency, I would tend to question the diagnosis and actually look for other types of PI that may have a subclass deficiency within the constellation of problems in that particular PI. Chronic diarrhea is another problem that we might see in patients with subclass deficiencies, not in the context of the IgG1 or IgG2 or IgG3 causing the diarrhea, but the fact that some subclass deficiencies are also associated with a deficiency in IgA. And when we have low IgA levels, one of the most common things we see is chronic diarrhea and gastrointestinal problems, okay? So if any of you have issues, if you have a subclass deficiency and chronic diarrhea or gastrointestinal complaints is a problem, I would make sure that you know what your IgA level is, because there is an association, as I'll mention in just a slide, I think, with IgA deficiency and one of the forms of subclass deficiencies. And that's the slide right here. So IgG2 subclass deficiency, I mentioned that's one of the most common forms of IgG subclass deficiency. And there is a fairly well-known association between IgG2 and IgA deficiency. These tend to have a more serious course. And in our practice, we actually group these patients in a slightly different category than pure subclass deficiencies. We sort of keep them in a different part of our brain, and we classify them more in the IgA deficient patient or even specific antibody deficiency patient. It's sort of, in our mind, a possible evolutionary immune deficiency that could change over time. So when we see this type of lab result where someone has a subclass deficiency and an IgA deficiency, and maybe, as Dr. Sorensen is going to mention in a few minutes, a specific antibody deficiency, we keep those patients a little closer on our radar, and we do some immunologic testing now and then to see if things are changing. Because as you all know, as we get older, our bodies change, we're not 18 anymore, and the same thing happens with our immune system. Their B cell production may change over time, and what starts as a isolated subclass deficiency could then become IgA deficiency and even CVID or common variable immune deficiency if we follow it over a good number of years. As I mentioned, these tend to have a more serious clinical course, probably because of the deficiency in IgA. They have more frequent upper and lower respiratory infections, and like I mentioned, the gastrointestinal symptoms in these patients can be quite troublesome. They tend to have chronic diarrhea, and they have a unique susceptibility to some infections like Giardia lamblia, which is a parasitic infection. They may have some problems with overgrowth of certain bacteria within the gut, and all these things can lead to some chronic GI complaints. And on the bottom, what I put was, this is the classic case of 1 + 1 does not equal 2. So in general, IgG2 subclass deficiencies tend to be on the mild side. IgA deficiency usually is on the mild side in regards to infections and symptoms. But when they occur together, they actually cause a much bigger problem than either deficiency alone. Let's talk a little bit about the type of infections that you might see in subclass deficiencies. And these are very similar to the infections you might see in patients who have total immunoglobulin deficiencies, like hypogammaglobulinemia, like common variable immune deficiency, like X-linked agammaglobulinemia or its other forms, even the forms of immunodeficiency like the hyper-IgM syndrome. Okay? So the pathogens that affect patients with subclass deficiency are the same ones that are common to all antibody deficiencies. The biggest problem we see are encapsulated bacteria called Streptococcus pneumoniae, Bronchomella or Moraxella catarrhalis, and then Haemophilus influenza. At the top of the screen on the right, I put IgG2 deficiency in a big yellow box, and that's because IgG2 has a unique role in preventing infections caused by these three bacteria and their other cousins that are surrounded by a sugar coat. Dr. Sorensen, I'm sure, will talk a little bit about that in more detail, but IgG2 is very important in preventing these types of infections that are caused by what we call encapsulated organisms, or organisms, bacteria, danger signals that have sugar coat all around them. IgG3 deficiency in yellow at the bottom right is there to remind us that IgG3 may have some role in preventing the infections on the top, but really we think it's important in preventing or eliminating viral infections. And in our practice, we have a few patients with true IgG3 subclass deficiencies who came to our clinic with really only a history of recurrent viral infections. And when we did our evaluation, the only deficiency or only problem we found was IgG3 in an almost absent range. So IgG2, bacterial infections, IgG3, viral infections. And that's why when you have a total hypogammaglobulinemia, you're susceptible, like CVID or hypogam or XLA, you're susceptible to all sorts of infections, both bacteria and viruses. So, I bet Dr. Sorensen has a similar slide in his lecture, because we steal and share this slide a lot. But this is really meant to remind us about how frequent antibody deficiencies are, how severe antibody deficiencies can be, and how both the frequency and severity may not actually match up. So there are some antibody deficiencies. I got to get my pointer. Here we go. Like, for example, X-linked agammaglobulinemia. These are present actually in a very small number within the general population. These are quite rare diseases, right? And we think, usually, that because these have a profound effect on the immune system, they typically result in quite serious infections, pneumonias, sepsis, and meningitis. IgG subclass deficiencies and IgA deficiency and potentially specific antibody deficiencies are much more common than we think, right? And typically, most immunologists feel that not because they're common, but one of the things is that these deficiencies don't really result in severe disease. They typically cause nuisance infections. But there are exceptions to that rule. And despite, or no matter what the immunologic severity is, so how much it affects your immune system, you may actually have quite severe infections if you have subclass deficiency, very similar to the case when you have agammaglobulinemia. So we make our decision to treat patients not always based upon the diagnosis, but how that diagnosis affects an individual patient, okay? So a patient with a mild or an IgG2 subclass deficiency who has a mild clinical course and doesn't have a lot of infections may not need some of the more serious treatment options. Whereas patients who have severe infections or a history of multiple pneumonias would absolutely qualify to receive, for example, immunoglobulin to prevent or treat those infections. So we make the decision about treatment of patients based upon what's on the right, their clinical severity. And what are those treatments? Well, I think in my practice, one of the most common treatments that I use for patients with subclass deficiency up front would be the use of antibiotics. And I use these antibiotics in what I call a prophylactic manner. I use almost daily antibiotics in the idea that I'm able to prevent infections, okay? I typically choose amoxicillin as my first line antibiotic, and I prescribe that daily. In children, I choose a dose that's based upon their weight, and in the adult population, I choose a dose that I feel is probably a good treatment dose to prevent infection, sometimes 500 milligrams of amoxicillin each day. I've also used azithromycin or Zithromax in a prophylactic manner. A colleague at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia recommended to me once to try that, and we might dose that Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to prevent infections. Bactrim or trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, that's the generic word, but most people know it as by the trade name Bactrim, can also be used daily to prevent infections. And I got that recommendation from another colleague who specializes in the treatment of agammaglobulinemia and who prescribes Bactrim to help prevent infections in all of her X-linked agammaglobulinemia patients. While I recommend and while I use antibiotics to treat patients with subclass deficiency, I really hesitate sometimes because I know that it has a large impact upon both gastrointestinal flora as well as in women in vaginal flora. And it can cause both yeast infections as well as an overgrowth of sort of bad bacteria within the gut. So we always consider GI side effects when we prescribe daily or routine antibiotics. In severe infections or in patients who have a major impact on their quality of life from their disease, We absolutely occasionally use IVIG or sub-Q immunoglobulin in the rare patient with subclass deficiency where it's warranted. And we almost always reserve the use of immunoglobulin in cases when the vaccine responses are clearly abnormal or meet the criteria based upon some recommendations that have been put together by other immunologists as to when a vaccine response is abnormal. Okay? All immunologists have patients in their practice who are being treated with immunoglobulin that may not necessarily meet every recommended criteria. But in general, we try to all do the same thing in regards to treatment so that there's some consistency among patients. So what is the inheritance of subclass deficiency? Many parents want to know if they have subclass deficiency, how will this impact their children or subsequent generations? And I really can say that there is no clear inheritance pattern. I think that if there is an inheritance pattern, then that might be a case where we're seeing the evolution of a subclass deficiency into another disease that has a well-defined genetic cause, okay? Again, at the bottom, I put this in about associations with other primary immunodeficiency diseases. So there are PI diseases where subclass deficiencies can be found. And two examples might be ataxia telangiectasia, which is a very rare primary immunodeficiency, and also the Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, which is also a very rare immunodeficiency. I think that most people in this audience don't really need to worry about these two diseases, okay? And that's because these diseases have very characteristic signs and symptoms, and those problems actually trump the subclass deficiency. So those are very different immune deficiencies that have other signs like difficulty walking, like severe eczema, other problems that are life-threatening. But if you look deeply into their immune system, you might find some different abnormalities, and one of them is a subclass deficiency. So what is the prognosis for subclass deficiencies? I think they're generally good. Most patients in our practice who have subclass deficiencies do very well if they're properly treated, if they're taking their daily or prophylactic antibiotics, and they're coming to us for routine follow-up so we can catch infections before they become a problem. Children with subclass deficiencies actually do very well. Patients who are under the age of 5, where we find a subclass deficiency if we look for it, tend to outgrow that abnormality in the majority of cases, and end up having normal immunity. It might be a form of illness that we call THI, or transient hypogammaglobulinemia of infancy, or a mild version of that. We often say in our clinics, which are generally for pediatric patients, that our immune system is much like any other part of our development. Not everyone develops at the same rate. If you look at a school classroom, some kids are 3 feet tall, some kids are 4 feet tall, and some are maybe 5 feet tall. They all are about the same age, but they've all developed at different rates. And our immune system can be just like that. We may just have a delay in the maturation of that immune system and the production of normal immunoglobulin levels. That being the case, I mentioned earlier that we are absolutely aware that some patients with subclass deficiencies may evolve or progress to another PI disease. Examples of that are specific antibody deficiency, hypogammaglobulinemia, or common variable immunodeficiencies. And with that, I want to thank you guys for coming. This is the Superdome actually right behind this wall, I think. And I will turn this over to Dr. Sorensen so that he can continue on to talk about specific antibody deficiencies, and then we'll open up the floor to questions, and you can ask us after that. Great.